Well, good morning.
This is Dan Arshak, and this is the Criminal Law Show. This is our second show, and we're excited to be talking about a variety of issues that really do affect your life, all of our lives, every day. This show addresses practical issues like what happens when you're arrested, what rights do you have when approached by the police, what happens if you're subpoenaed to testify in a case. I'd like to hear from listeners about their experiences in the criminal justice system, what worked, what didn't work, was it fair, why not. We'll talk about public affair issues. Should marijuana or drugs be legalized? What does it mean to be legalized? What would the results be if they were legalized? Should juries be informed that they have the right to vote their conscience when they believe laws are wrong? Currently, they're not informed of that, although they have the absolute right as citizens to make that decision. Historically, citizens have made that sort of decision in draft dodging cases, vigilante law cases, marijuana cases. There are national issues which we want to talk to, which relate to the direction in which the Supreme Court is moving. What changes in the requirements of giving Miranda warnings have on our due process rights, and on and on. We'll talk about, well, what are Miranda warnings? What are important about those? We can talk about, on the international stage, the tremendous developments in the international criminal tribunals in The Hague and Rwanda and Cambodia and Lebanon and other places which affect the development of law here and in developing countries around the world. I love this stuff. I've practiced law for incredibly almost 30 years. I love talking to people about their ideas and the ways that these sorts of issues affect their lives. And one of the most frequent questions that I get asked over and over as a criminal defense attorney, and I'm okay with people asking me the question, but the question that criminal defense attorneys get asked over and over is, how do you represent those people? I want to play you a little song that, for me, really answers that question. How do you represent those people? Before I play it, I want to tell you that I'm hoping, especially today, that you'll take the opportunity to call in with questions that you might have or comments that you might have about the criminal justice system. The number here is 518-828-0290. Feel free to call in. Your call will be answered, and then you'll be handed over to me, and we'll have a talk. You'll be on the air, so keep it clean and keep it lean. But please do call in. The number again is 518-828-0290. And now here's a cut, a little song that explains, by my lights, how it is that we can do this work.
This song says, no matter who you are, no matter where you go in your life, at some point you're gonna need somebody to stand by you.
You understand why we chose that particular cut for you to listen to. It's about standing by. standing by somebody when they need somebody to stand by them. And the answer to the question, how can you represent those people, is just that. You know, I don't mean to get too mushy about this or too religious, but for me, the issue really is a religious one. For me, I think, you know, what would a really ethical person do? What would Jesus do? What would a person do if they had to make a choice about who to stand by when someone's charged with a crime? Do we stand by? Do I want to stand by the police? Do I want to stand by the government? Or do I want to stand by that powerless person who at that moment, when they're at their darkest time, in the darkest room, am I going to be the guy who stands by that person and gives them a voice in a system that requires them to have a voice? Listen just to a little bit more of that song, and then we're going to get into the meat and potatoes of this show.
No, I won't be afraid. No, I won't. She's one kid just as long as your people come and stand by me.
What defense attorneys do, they stand by you. And if you ever wonder, as you're watching a TV show, as you're seeing a movie that has a criminal defense lawyer in it, when you're reading the newspaper about criminal defense stories, you wonder, how can that man, that woman, get up in the morning and represent somebody, stand by somebody who's charged with that terrible offense? I hope you'll think to this song and you'll think about what's the moral thing to do and what's the harder thing to do, and that is to stand by the person at their real hour of need. You know, in anticipation of today's show, I reached out to high schools in Cairo and in Hudson and asked people there to get questions to me about criminal law issues that affect their lives. And we have a whole number of issues that I want to talk about, and I'm going to answer those questions through the course of the show. But before we do, in order to answer those questions, we need to use words. That might not surprise you, but words are what all of this is about. And it's not just random words. It's words that end up making sense. I'm in the course of reading a wonderful book by Jan Martel. He wrote the book Life of Pi. And he wrote a new book called Beatrice and Virgil, which in large measure is a remarkable discussion between a howler monkey and a donkey. During the course of his book, he makes a comment that I thought was just so important. And really, it's all about words. At the end of the day, I'm focusing on this because the whole criminal justice system is about words. It's about the words that get said to police officers. It's about the words that police officers say to citizens, judges say to jurors say in court, lawyers and prosecutors say in court. It's all about words. And they're not just random words. So, you know, Jan Martel, in his book, he's talking about the knowledge of history and the need we have to understand history. He talks about stories, and of course, criminal defense, criminal trials are all about stories. Stories identify, they unify, they give meaning to things, just like music. Now, music is noise. It's just noise, but it's noise that makes sense. And art can just be lines. It can just be color. It can just be shapes. But for it to be art, in some way, to each of us, it has to make sense. And so a story is a piece of life that makes sense. And that resonated with me as a criminal defense attorney, because at the end of the day, our whole criminal justice system is really, it's not about a search for the truth. It's not about convicting the guilty. No, it's about the power of government to punish people. If people want the opportunity to find out if somebody is guilty, well, that's a thing that happens. That finding of guilt is a thing that happens inside somebody's mind. What happens in the courtroom is only an exercise by which we permit, assuming a set of circumstances, we permit the government to punish somebody. And so while painting is a color that makes sense and music is noise that makes sense, the criminal justice system is punishment that makes sense. And if it doesn't make sense, there's something wrong with it. So in order to answer the questions of the people from our local high schools, it's important to understand what some of the terms are that we're dealing with. And to do that, I thought that it makes some sense to walk through the process of a criminal case. What is it that happens? How does it begin? And in order to do that, we'll start really right at the beginning of any criminal case, and that is that something in the world happens. A house gets broken into, a bank gets robbed, some money gets stolen, a person gets punched, some drugs are sold, a car gets banged into, somebody screams at somebody in a threatening way, a murder is committed. Things happen. Something happens in the world. And that causes some people, on some occasions, to decide that the government needs to be engaged. Well, what part of government are we talking about? We all remember, and here's your a piece of your civics lesson for the day, we all remember that there are three parts of government. There's the executive branch, there's the judiciary, and there's the legislative branch. We talk about the three parts of government, and those three branches are represented in any criminal trial. When you try and figure out who the executive branch is in a criminal case, think about who are the people who have control of the guns, because that's really what the executive branch does. They control the power. And in our country, as in many countries, power is defined by who has control of the guns. So police have control of the guns. They work for the executive branch. The police are answerable to the prosecutors and the assistant district attorneys or the United States attorneys. Those are part of the executive branch. The judiciary is, of course, represented by the judges, and the judges are there for one very, very important purpose. They're there to define and explain how the law gets applied to the facts of any case. They're not investigators. They're not advocates. Ideally, they don't care how a case turns out. They want to be able to assure that that the law, as it's written by the legislature, there's your third element, the law as it's written by the legislature and as it's explained and defined by other judges is applied correctly in every case. And so something happens in the world. Let's say it's an observation made by a citizen that a person appears to be selling some drugs on a corner near their home, and they call the police, and the police arrive. Well, they call the police because the police are empowered to exercise what power they have to bring people, to deprive people of some liberty for a particular purpose. And so the police may arrive at the scene and interact with somebody who they see who may or may not look like the individual who was identified by the person who called the police. And and they may decide that, in fact, that is the person who was identified. They may speak to that person, and they may decide, based on the answers to questions that they have received, that this person is going to be restrained or arrested. So the first question that we have is, what's the right of the police to approach any particular individual at any particular time and either speak to them or restrain them in any way? Police are people, we're happy to know, and they have the absolute right at any time to approach and speak to any person at any time about anything. What they're not permitted to do without some sort of restraint, without there being some, as lawyers like to say, articulable reason, an actual reason, they're not permitted to actually stop a person or restrain them in their liberty in some way without an adequate reason. And there's a whole body of law that explains what those adequate reasons are. But whether or not those adequate reasons exist, the police may engage with a person at that point in time. And this is actually a great place to segue into one of the first questions that I received from the high school students, and that was that a person wrote that that they were really just walking down their street, and a police car pulled up with two police in it, got out, and asked them to stand still and asked them to take off their backpacks. Two people were walking down the street, and then looked in their backpacks. Nothing was found. They were given their backpacks back, and they were permitted to go on their way. And the question to me was, is that okay? Is that legitimate? Are they permitted to do that? And the short answer to that question is, without any more information, the clear answer is no. They're not permitted to do that. We don't live in a police state. The police are only permitted to conduct a search of somebody if they have an articulable reason to believe that that particular person at that particular time is engaged in some kind of illegal activity. And so what do we think about police who see it as their right or their obligation to stop people on the street, as happened to these high school students, search their belongings, and then send them on their way? If you have an idea about what we think about that, or if you have thoughts about those situations, please do feel free to call me at 518-828-0290. So my answer to the high school student who sent in that question is, no, the police don't have a right to do that without some additional information available to them. And what's the appropriate response if the police stop you under those circumstances? My general response, you know, I've raised four kids, and my response to my kids when they ask that question is, when a person with a gun comes and asks you to do something, you respond politely and you do what they ask you to do. It's not right. It's not a legitimate use of police force. But under those circumstances, at that time, it's the wrong time to stake out a claim and challenge the authority of a person who's standing in front of you with a gun. My firmest advice to people who are approached in that way is behave respectfully, behave politely, follow the orders of the person who has the gun. You're absolutely free to say to them that you don't believe that they have the right to interact with you that way. But at the end of the day, if they're bound and determined to do that, they will do it. And you can certainly take appropriate action after the event takes place. You can report them to the police department. You can make a complaint to any number of organizations that exist for that purpose. In New York City, there's something called the Civilian Complaint Review Board that reviews complaints against police officers. And the more that citizens shine a light on behaviors that violate our due processes, the less it is that the police will feel free and unrestrained from engaging in that kind of activity. So back to our hypothetical case, the police receive a report of a drug sale on a corner. They receive a description of the person who was selling the drugs. They are told where the drugs are being secreted, and they go. They see a person who answers that description, and they find the drugs hidden in the bumper of a car where the caller said that they would be, and they arrest the person charged with a crime. So I used a word just now that needs some attention, and that's arrest. What does it mean to be arrested? Let's go back to the high school student who had their backpack searched. They were stopped by the police. They felt as though they were not free to go for that period of time. They were restrained for a few minutes while the police searched their backpacks, and then they were permitted to go. Were they arrested? Well, the answer, like most answers that come from lawyers, is that it depends. It depends what a reasonable person in their circumstances would have believed. From a legal perspective, no, those high school students weren't arrested, the person who is restrained and detained and handcuffed and put in the back of a police car, like this hypothetical person arrested for selling drugs, that person would have a reasonable belief that they in fact were arrested, and they would be right. They have been arrested. And that person has begun their journey through the criminal justice system. Well, what's one of the first things that we all think ought to happen to that person when he's put in the back of a police car and is in the process of being charged with selling drugs? Commonly, and we see it on television shows all the time, we hear that somebody is telling them about their rights, and the rights include statements like you have the right to remain silent and you have the right to an attorney, and if you can't afford one, one will be appointed for you. If you make any statements, those statements may be used against you in a court of law. Those sorts of statements are all part and parcel of what's known as the Miranda rights, and frequently we hear questions, and in fact, one of the questions from the high school students that I received was, if when we are stopped by the police, they don't give us our Miranda rights, is the stop illegal? And it's a common perception, we hear it as criminal defense attorneys on a very frequent basis, that if the police fail to give you a rendition of your Miranda rights, your right to remain silent, that therefore the arrest, and perhaps in some people's minds, the entire criminal case can be thrown out. The short answer to that is that's wrong. There is absolutely no obligation for the police ever to provide a person with their Miranda rights until and if there is an intention on the part of the police to use a statement that a person is about to make in the case against them. And so if, for instance, a person is arrested and charged with a crime and they're not provided with their Miranda rights, and the case proceeds to trial, and the police want to use a statement that a person made after they were arrested, and they were not provided with their Miranda rights, it may well be that a judge would find that the state is not permitted to use those statements against the person at their trial. On the other hand, if they were provided with their Miranda rights and it was clear that they were understood those Miranda rights at the time that they were given, then the statements that a person gives after they've been, as we say, Mirandized, after we've been told what our rights are with regard to making statements or not, then those statements may be able to be used against the person during a subsequent trial. One of the other questions that I received from the high school students here was one of them was aware that at some point somebody or some authority, either somebody with the school or police, had searched the student's locker. And the student thought that, in fact, that was a private area that that only the student should have access to, and that neither the school authorities nor the police should have had access to that. And the short answer to that student is you're wrong. School lockers are not private places. The things that are kept in school lockers are things that anybody should believe are not going to be private. And if there is a concern by any person that there's something in a school locker that if somebody looked at it might get them in trouble, my best advice to them is that they do not rely on an erroneous belief that that locker is a privileged area that either the police or the school cannot get into, because the truth is they can. It's legitimate for them to do it. It's not the student's private area, and each person should proceed accordingly. You know, we just got a question from a caller, and again, the number is 518-828-0290, which relates to the Miranda rights, and the question is, what's the proof that someone was given their Miranda rights? What if the police say they did it, and a defendant says they didn't? Well, that's a classic kind of situation. Often, when we speak to people who are charged with crimes after they've been arrested and processed through the system, they'll tell us that they were never given their Miranda rights. No one said anything to them about their right to remain silent. The police, in one way or another, they'll tell us, pressured them to make a statement, and later we will be told by the prosecutor who's spoken to the police that the police say that they did give them their Miranda rights before the statement was made. It's a difficult situation to be in because it's a, you know, it's a he said sort of scenario, and it's a scenario in which the person who finally makes the decision about whether or not a statement will be admitted in a particular case is a judge. The judge will hear a police officer testify that he did give Miranda rights at a particular point in time, and he may hear a defendant also testify that no Miranda rights were given. And I can tell you, based on 30 years of experience, that when it comes down to a straight-up match between the believability of a police officer and a defendant charged with a crime, that 99% of the time a judge is going to find that they believe the police officer. There has been, and many of you may have heard of it, a terrible spate of issues that have occurred, and mostly publicized in large metropolitan areas around the country, of police officers who have, in an organized way, tried to conform their testimony in cases to conform to what they understand the Constitution requires, regardless of whether or not what they're saying is true. And it's called testa-lying. Police officers have been known to make up facts to fit a circumstance. And let's be clear, witnesses and defendants have been known to make up facts to fit a particular circumstance as well that benefits their side of the story. The notion that a police officer would take the stand and lie, I think might reasonably affect us as citizens very differently than the idea of a defendant taking the stand and perhaps not telling the truth. As a citizen, I'm deeply troubled by the notion that a police officer would do anything but come to the stand and tell the absolute unvarnished truth, and then let the chips fall where they might. Police officer's not an advocate. They don't have a dog in the fight. They've got no skin in the game. They shouldn't, at any rate. The idea that for whatever reason they might be inclined to push one aspect of their view of a case in order to try and get a conviction is deeply troubling. Why, you might ask, would a police officer do that? And that segues in very nicely, actually, into one of the most common misperceptions about criminal defense practice or criminal cases in general, and that is that at the end of the case, if there is at the end of a trial, if there is a not guilty verdict, that doesn't mean that the defense attorney won the case. It really only means that the prosecutor lost the case. And by that I mean that in our country, there can be no conviction in a criminal case, and really we only care about a conviction so that we can thereafter punish. And you remember what I said about the whole purpose of our criminal justice system is to have punishment make sense. There can be no punishment in a criminal case unless the prosecution has brought a certain amount of evidence to the table. The defense in our system has no obligation to bring any evidence to the table. It's only the prosecutor that has that obligation. And so if there is, at the end of the day, a finding of not guilty, and let's be clear, you heard me say the word not guilty. I didn't say a finding of innocent. I didn't say a finding of he or she didn't do it. I said a finding of not guilty. We're going to come back to that. If at the end of the day there's a finding of not guilty, it's only because there wasn't enough evidence brought into the courtroom. So defense lawyers don't win cases. And certainly defense lawyers don't win cases on something called a technicality. There are no such things. In a trial, in a courtroom, prosecutors either present enough evidence or they don't present enough evidence. And that's the determination that a jury makes at the end of the day to decide whether a person can be sentenced and punished or not. I said a moment ago that the question that a jury answers at the end of the case is whether somebody is guilty or not guilty. And the importance of that notion is that there is not a finding in our system that a person is innocent of the crime. And so at the end of the day, all that's established in a courtroom after a trial is that there has been a certain amount of evidence produced. The problem with that system, and I'm not saying that it's a deeply flawed system, but the problem with that system is that we can be certain that since we're not making a determination as to actual guilt, that is, we know as a matter of certainty, of moral certainty, that a person did a thing, or we know as a matter of certainty, of moral certainty, that a person did not do a thing. We're not making that determination. We are certain then that if all that we're requiring a prosecutor to do is generate a certain level of evidence in a court, we're certain that from time to time we will be convicting people of crimes that they did not commit. What a horrifying thought that is. What a horrifying thought. Think of your fathers. Think of your mothers. Think of your brothers and your uncles. And it's mostly men. And it's mostly men of color. Think of them. And think that any one of them could, any one of them could, at any moment, become engaged in a criminal prosecution as an innocent person. And could be convicted of a crime as an innocent person, and could be sentenced as an innocent person, and spend the rest of their lives in jail, or, God forbid, be sentenced to death and killed. How could that happen in our system? It could happen because our system, and let's remember this, and let's remember it when you watch the television shows and the movies and the the dramatic presentations of witnesses breaking down on the stand. Let's remember that the whole process isn't about proving somebody guilty or not. It's only about determining that there's enough evidence to permit the government to punish. If you want certainty, go to church. If you want the opportunity to punish somebody, well, the courtroom is your place. You know, in anticipation of today's show, I reached out to some of the most experienced criminal defense attorneys in the country, and I asked them what are some of the major misconceptions about criminal law and our criminal justice system in general. And I want to run down their list a little bit and share it with you. And as you read the newspaper next week, and you'll see the front page of the newspaper, look at the Daily Mail, look at the Star Register, almost every day there are stories about criminal law issues on the front page, above the fold. These are the things that that people care about. You know, the Daily Mail indicates what its most common read articles are. It turns out it's the police blotter. That's what people read the most online. They care about what people are getting arrested for and charged with, and if they know somebody, and what it means to them if somebody gets arrested for a crime. These are the issues that people care about. And as you read these stories, ask yourself, do I understand really what these words mean? So as I spoke to criminal defense lawyers and some prosecutors across the country this last week, some of the issues that they raise are food for thought for you And I hope you'll give these items thought as you read the papers and you watch your television shows and your movies going forward. Remember, one prosecutor said, "We don't always find out who actually committed the crime. All the questions aren't answered at the end. All that we're able to determine is whether we have enough evidence beyond a reasonable doubt to punish somebody." Interesting point. She also said, "Good guys don't always win." She was careful to point out to me that she meant by that good guys defendants and good guys prosecutors don't always win. And I thought it was quite remarkable that she also noted that guilty verdicts don't mean that the person committed the crime. So when you read the newspaper, Saturday's newspaper, the Daily Register, part of the Hudson Catskill newspapers that don't cover WGXC at all, by the way. Saturday's newspaper had a headline that said that a co-arc worker is charged with sex abuse. And, of course, the notion that we take from that is that how terrible it is that somebody, co-arc, those of you who don't know should know, is a program that provides services to developmentally disabled people. And so the idea that that a worker for that kind of organization would actually engage in sex abuse with one of the people that they're obligated to help is, of course, deeply troubling. But if you drill down in that story, what you see is the charge is a misdemeanor, which is the lowest level of criminal charge in New York State. And we also know that the person who made the allegation against this worker is obviously a developmentally disabled person who may have some sort of issues with reporting accurately the things that may or may not have happened to them. The behavior that was complained about was a pat on the person's rear end. When we see a headline like co-arc worker charged with sex abuse, we have an image in our minds of what that really means. If you drill down into the article and read it a little bit more carefully, sometimes the issues are not nearly as clear as they originally appeared. I want to point out as well another article that was in the Saturday paper that reported that, and you'll recall in Catskill in 2006, there was a killing of a person, and James Pine and Michael Deo were charged with that killing. James Pine went to trial and was convicted, and even the newspaper got it wrong at the when the appellate court issued its ruling with regard to that case. Mr. Pine had gone to trial. He had contested the case, and as I've explained to you, a jury found that there was sufficient evidence to have convicted him, and he was thereafter sentenced, because that's what trials do. They decide if there's enough evidence to punish a person. On the other hand, Mr. Deo, in fact, didn't go to trial. He decided that he didn't want to risk going to trial, and he decided to plead guilty. And after he pled guilty, he actually testified for the prosecution against Mr. Pine, and was thereafter sentenced as well to about a third as much time as Mr. Mr. Pine was sentenced to. Mr. Pine received a 25-year sentence, and Mr. Deo received an 8-year sentence. And they both appealed their convictions in that case. Mr. Pine appealed because he thought that there wasn't sufficient evidence to convict him. And interestingly, Mr. Deo appealed because he thought that the attorney who had represented him at his plea had not instructed him sufficiently about the sort of sentence that he would be exposed to and what sort of deal he would or would not receive from the prosecutor if, in fact, he testified on behalf of the prosecutor and against Mr. Pine at Mr. Pine's trial. Thereafter, after those appeals were filed, the appellate court issued a decision that said, well, the amount of evidence that was presented against Mr. Pine was sufficient, but they found some important issues in the appeal that was filed on his behalf by a fairly well-known local attorney, Greg Lubow. Greg used to be the public defender for Greene County, and he took up Mr. Deo's case to the appellate division, and his application to the appellate division was, there should have been a hearing at the trial level during which a trial court could have determined whether the kind of representation that Mr. Deo received was the kind that a man should receive before being convicted of such a terrible case. And the appellate division agreed with Greg and has now sent the case back to the trial division for them to make a determination about the sort of representation that was given to Mr. Deo before he pled guilty and before he was sentenced for this crime. Even the Daily Mail got it wrong in their reporting of the appeals court decision, where they said that the appellate division had affirmed the conviction and the jury's finding of guilt against Mr. Pine and Mr. Deo. Of course, they didn't do that. Greg wrote a letter to the Daily Mail, which was published, pointing out the error. But it's important for us to recognize that it's complicated stuff. And we can't take as a given the description of what it is that we read in the newspapers as gospel every time we see it there. Drill down, look at it, ask yourself if, noise being music, only if it makes sense. Ask yourself whether the news, which are just words, makes sense when you drill down. One of the defense attorneys who I have spoken to about issues that are misapprehended or misunderstood in criminal cases thought that it was important that I make mention of the fact that most arrests are for very minor crimes that can result in the ruination of people when they really haven't done anything very bad. And while that's very true, people who get arrested for possession of very small amounts of marijuana, driving under the influence, are very serious crimes in people's lives and can have a terrible effect on their lives. It's not as though I'm suggesting that those people shouldn't be charged with a crime, but we don't sometimes recognize how serious those issues can be in a person's life. I can tell you that one of the most frequent calls that criminal defense attorneys get is from people who have been convicted of crimes who want us to file an application to expunge or seal their criminal record. And all of you who are listening to this in New York State should understand that there is no zero opportunity to do that in New York State. Once you have a criminal record in New York State, you have it for life. There have recently been some programs involving people who engage in drug treatment may have the opportunity to have some portion of their record conditionally sealed. But for the most part, please understand that if you or someone you know is convicted of a crime in New York State, that will be on their record until the day they die. There's simply no wiggle room in that. I want to return just for a moment to that person who the police arrested on the street after a complaint of drug selling. And he's now been arrested. I say he because most of the time it's he, and as I said, most of the time it's a black or Hispanic person. And they're taken to the local precinct or the local police station. And so let's just back up to a moment to the one issue that I want to leave in your minds as we come closer to the end of this hour. And that is, and I've said it twice now, that most of the people who are arrested are black and Hispanic people. And what is that about? And why is that? And what do we make of that? Every single study of the prevalence of crime in the United States comes to the same conclusion that crime, the commission of crime, is equal across affluent and poorer communities. It's equal between white and non-white communities, and despite that equality, that even-handed distribution of the experience of crime across our communities, we know that the vast majority of people who are in jail and who are arrested and who are engaged with by the police and who are convicted are black and are mostly black and Hispanic men. And we need to ask ourselves as a culture why that is and how that can be. And when I say that, I really do mean that if you think that there's a much more serious drug problem in the black or Hispanic community down the block, across the tracks, away from where you live, if you happen not to be black and Hispanic, you are just simply wrong. Your neighbors, the friends of your neighbors, the people that you go to church with, they are engaged in illegal and illicit activities to the same extent and with the same prevalence as the people who you may view as living on the other side of the tracks. And you need to ask yourself, why is it that most of the time when I'm asked to stand by somebody, I stand by somebody of color? With that, I'm going to fade into conclusion of that wonderful song, Stand By Me, and I look forward to seeing you next month, the first Sunday of the month at 11 o'clock, and I would be failing in my duty, however, if I didn't tell you that we are in a fundraising drive at WGXC. I'm going to ask each of you who listen to this to write a check, make it payable to WGXC, and send it somewhere. I'm going to tell you where to send it to. I'm going to have you send it to the Hudson Studios at 704 Columbia Street, second floor, Hudson, New York, 12534. Community radio is a blessing. It's unusual. It's special. It comes to you because you deserve it, and therefore you deserve to pay for it. Talk to you in a month.
This song says, no matter who you are, no matter where you go in your life, at some point you're going to need somebody to stand by you. Oh yeah,
Just as long as your people come and stand by me.